Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Can drug companies outrun Ebola? When competition gives way to a crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, October 22nd, and it's great to have you with us. We are going to start today with the drug industry and its reaction to Ebola. Ebola infected 1,000 people in West Africa in just the past week, according to the World Health Organization. And Johnson & Johnson is the latest company to say it will join the race to find a vaccine. They'd like to start human trials as soon as January. J&J is even talking with its rival, GlaxoSmithKline, about a collaboration. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on why the industry has kicked into high gear.
Most days, Johnson & Johnson and GlaxoSmithKline are fierce rivals. Glaxo's Donna Altenpohl says most days, drug makers aren't facing an Ebola outbreak.
What you're seeing is you're seeing a collaboration among industry, collaboration with governments, to really address what is becoming a horrific public health crisis.
Until recently, developing a vaccine wasn't viewed as lucrative. But Adil Mahmoud, former president of Merck Vaccines, says the power of this virus is persuasive.
What has changed today is failure of almost all control methods that we know that exist.
Mahmoud says with public health efforts like quarantine and containment falling short, it's now obvious a vaccine is needed. It's clear there's a huge market. It's not clear how profitable that market will be. But believe it or not, that's secondary to drug makers, says USC economist Joel Hay.
They hope that if they develop good vaccines that they will be compensated at some point. But I don't think they're doing this out of a profit motive. I think they really are doing it because they believe it's the right thing to do.
Certainly, down the road, the company that comes up with a vaccine first could score a major public relations win. But right now, Hay says nobody, including the drug makers, stand to benefit if Ebola spreads beyond West Africa.
Just think what would happen if people thought that airplanes were not safe to fly in. You know, the economy could be devastated very quickly.
Hay says for pharmaceutical companies in the business of making people better, it's gut check time. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Ever since the housing crisis, regulators have been trying to strike a tough balance. Tougher lending standards than the ones that caused the subprime mess, while keeping credit flowing. This week, federal regulators rewrote some of the standards on how much buyers should put down for a house and decided 20%? Maybe not. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has the story of how that whole notion of 20% got started in the first place.
As with so much of our economic life, it all goes back to the Great Depression,
which came with a foreclosure crisis and a construction halt, similar to what happened after the recent great financial crisis.
Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate finance at the Wharton School. She says after the Depression came the Federal Housing Administration, backing only loans with a 20% down payment. By the 1950s, that government standard became an industry standard. Chris Polychrone is the incoming president of the National Association of Realtors.
When I bought my first home, it was $22,000. And I had to put 20% down, but it was a conventional loan.
With the exception of the run-up to the financial crisis, the average down payment has remained 20% to this day.
So I think the 20% down payment has become the default, no pun intended.
Jonathan Miller is president of Miller Samuel, a real estate appraisal company. He says the reason for the 20%
really still has a lot to do with mortgage insurance.
With anything less than 20% down, the only way to get a government-backed mortgage is to buy private mortgage insurance. But how did 20% become that dividing line in the first place, back in the 1930s? As with so much of our economic life, it's anybody's guess.
If you score an 80%, you're a B-minus student, and I guess that means you're above average. So maybe that has something to do with it.
In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, seems like traders weren't too happy about the price of oil. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Now a story that gives us a rare glimpse into the effects of Western sanctions on the Russian economy. Russian businesses are hurting, and that's led to nasty infighting among the country's elite. One oligarch is now under house arrest, facing charges of fraud and money laundering. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
The case against Vladimir Yevtushenkov sounds familiar. Remember Yukos? The giant Russian oil company was broken up a decade ago. The oligarch owner had clashed politically with Putin, was stripped of his shares, jailed, and had his company carved up and fed to rival plutocrats. But Yevtushenkov is different in one crucially important respect.
He is widely regarded as a figure who is loyal to the authorities in Russia. He's never previously stepped out of line.
John Luff of the Chatham House think tank says Yevtushenkov's been the very model of a modern Russian oligarch.
He's never criticized the authorities, to my knowledge. But it's very striking that a figure so loyal to the system, who's never stepped out of line, has been put in this situation.
His problems began when a rival businessman took a fancy to some of his oil company assets. The rival, who's much closer to Putin, made Yevtushenkov an offer. Yevtushenkov deemed it derisory and refused. Lawyer Jameson Firestone says there's no mystery about the fate of the fallen oligarch.
He's got something they want, and they want to take it. It's pretty simple.
Firestone knows more than most about such shenanigans. He fled Moscow after his colleague Sergei Magnitsky died in custody after allegedly uncovering high-level corruption. Firestone says this case shows the same Putin-esque respect for the rule of law.
Like in the Soviet Union, there is no such thing as private property in Russia. You own stuff while they allow you to own it.
Putin must have approved this attempted asset grab. Nick Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
This case is a case of a Putin oligarch turning on a non-Putin oligarch.
The oligarch, who's a close friend and ally of Putin, runs the giant state-owned oil company Rosneft. The company is suffering under US and EU sanctions and in the general Russian economic downturn. That's why it wants a piece of Yevtushenkov's action.
The pie, if you like, is no longer growing, and therefore the fights over particular portions can become more excessive.
But this may not just be a case of Putin backing a greedy oligarch who covets the possessions of another less well-connected one. John Luff of Chatham House says Putin may have singled out the unoffending Yevtushenkov as a preemptive example.
There are some Russian business people who interpret this as being a sign to business from Mr. Putin that you may be unhappy with what's going on at the moment, you may be feeling a degree of pain, but don't think of stepping out of line.
It's a risky tactic. It could, says Jameson Firestone, alienate all the oligarchs in the outer circle and eventually lead to the president's toppling. This could be curtains for Putin.
Most of Russian transitions in power happen the following way. You wake up in the morning, Swan Lake is playing on every single official channel, and then you know something's happened. A few hours later, when they figure out the official story, somebody gets on TV and tells us who the new leadership is.
But the Russian leader's public approval rating stands at around 80%, and all the oligarchs are universally unpopular. Whatever happens to Yevtushenkov, it still could be some years before Putin has his Swan Lake moment. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The official rulebook for federal employees has more than 60 reasons to miss work and still get paid. But it turns out that tens of thousands of federal workers, some being disciplined, some being caught in bureaucracy, have been on paid administrative leave for more than a month, some even a year. Those startling numbers were reported by Lisa Rhine at The Washington Post, and she joins me now. Welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
Do we even know how many federal workers are on administrative leave right now?
Not really. This is a number that has never really been, no one's really made an attempt to figure this out. But three Republicans in Congress asked the Government Accountability Office to do an audit of this question. And they did come up with some numbers, which said that 57,000 federal workers over a three-year period from fiscal 2011 through fiscal 2013 were on what we'd call extended administrative leave. But the GAO was only able to get data for about three-fifths of the federal workforce. And that's just because many federal agencies just don't keep the data.
In some cases, these are folks who have some sort of disciplinary investigation going on, or we don't know exactly what's going on, and yet they're going home and they're getting paid and they're part of the federal workforce.
Right. And none of the employees that I've ever spoken to who have been in this kind of virtual home detention have ever said that it's fun, or ever said that they wanted to be sidelined at home for so long, even though they were, you know, collecting pensions and their salaries and accruing, you know, sick days and vacation days. But what happens in government is that you can't, like you can in a private company, you can't just summarily fire someone who you suspect of doing something. So if they're accused of some sort of wrongdoing and they've broken a rule or they're accused of that, the government basically decides that they're, you know, they need to be sent home because they can't, you know, keep them in the office. But the real tension point here, I think, is that they end up being at home for months and in many cases years while their cases are investigated.
Do we know how much this whole lengthy process is costing taxpayers?
Well, over the three-year period that the Government Accountability Office studied, the entire gamut of administrative leave cost the government $3.1 billion. But the sum the taxpayers paid for these extended periods of leave that basically went from 1 month to 3 years was about a quarter of that. So, you know, $750 million.
That's a fair chunk of change.
Yeah, yeah.
Why does this take so long?
Well, that's the most interesting question. I think it's that federal managers are just risk averse. You know, they always worry that they're going to get in trouble if they do something. So in many ways, putting someone on admin leave is the easy way out. And so this goes to the bottom of the to-do list. And I did speak to many people in the private sector, HR experts, who said, oh boy, you know, at a private company, this would never happen. The cases are dispatched, you know, much more quickly. So an employee is exonerated or they're fired, and that's the end of it.
So you laid all of this out there in your article. Is it going to change?
Well, right now, the change would probably have to be initiated by Congress. There are a couple of members of Congress who are interested in changing the law so that the law for the first time would address the question of administrative leave and how long it could actually last.
Lisa Ryan covers the federal government for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Coming up, how does the economy feel to you? We get one listener's take.
Overall, things are better, but the people haven't come to accept it yet.
But first, let's do the numbers. Shares fell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 153 points, 0.9%, to close at 16,461. The NASDAQ fell 36 points, 0.8%, to finish the day at 4,382. The S&P 500 was down 14 points, 0.75%, to end at 1,927. Yahoo clicked up 4.5% on better-than-expected third-quarter revenue. Broadcom leapt 5.5% after announcing profits that beat analysts' expectations. And Six Flags rode up 12.75%. The entertainment company's profits and earnings were both better than expected. Boeing slumped despite beating profit expectations. The aviation company was down almost 4.5%. Europe's markets rose. Germany's DAX drove up 0.6%. Britain's FTSE advanced 0.4%. France's CAC 40 was up almost 0.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. See any Post-its on your desk? 3M is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And on October 23rd, 2001, Apple unveiled the iPod. It could store 1,000 songs. Much easier than jogging at the gym clutching 100 CDs. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. You've probably heard the phrase, corner the market, right? It's not all that often that someone really tries to do it. Nelson Bunker Hunt did, with the world's silver market. He died yesterday at age 88. He was an heir to the Hunt oil fortune and, at one time, among the richest people on the planet. But a huge bet on the silver market in the late 70s and early 80s led to a silver craze, and then to a financial debacle that threatened a whole lot more than his fortune. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Hunt's obituary in the Dallas Morning News describes him as an oil man, patriot, horseman, Christian, and John Birch Society member, among other things. But in financial circles, he and his brother were best known for owning a frighteningly big chunk of the world's silver. They wanted to hedge against raging inflation, they said. Columbia University's John Coffey.
They bid up the price of silver from $9 an ounce to at its peak, something like $50 an ounce in January 1980.
But when worried regulators set new trading limits on silver, the Hunts couldn't meet a margin call. Silver prices collapsed, they lost over $1 billion, their lenders were in trouble, and yes, a federal bailout of sorts ensued. Hunt declared bankruptcy, the largest personal bankruptcy in American history. Russ Munch was his lawyer.
It took me probably 30 days to get an organizational chart dealing with probably more than 250 companies that he owned or had an interest in all over the world.
Jeffrey Williams, who wrote a book about the Hunt case, says lots of people lost money, but reforms, not so much.
The more time has passed, the more I'm forced to conclude that the case actually did not have very much effect on the way we regulate commodity markets.
Jim Stone, who chaired the Commodity Futures Trading Commission at the time, today said the silver crisis nearly torpedoed top financial institutions in much the same way mortgage derivatives did in 2008. The Hunts were highly leveraged, and that problem, Stone says, remains unfixed and the lesson unlearned. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Let's say you go to the grocery store to buy some salmon. It can be confusing to figure out the sustainable way to eat. The Western drought has threatened young fish. Prices go up and down. We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to a tributary of the Columbia River to explain the laws of supply and demand in fish.
Heading down this bumpy little road into a gorge on the Klickitat River in Washington to a Yakima native fishing site. And I'm seeing a bunch of men in a beat-up blue pickup truck throwing salmon into an ice bucket.
Maybe 200 fish maybe in there. The cohos, the silvers, which are a little smaller than a Chinook. So when they really get moving, we could fill, you know, four or five of these.
Ira Yallop's family has been fishing the spring and fall salmon runs here for generations. It's a traditional method. The men stand on rickety scaffolds built over the falls and use dip nets. It's like a butterfly net, only 25 feet long and steel reinforced, to pull the salmon out of the water.
You're just pulling it out of the net, about a 15-pounder.
That's no fish story. One of the fishermen just picked a supersized king salmon out of the falls. It'll command a premium price in Seattle or Portland, upwards of $20 a pound. I asked Yallop, how's the fishing?
This is the most fish I've ever seen. This year, with the significant amount of fish that have returned, the price has dropped, you know, because there's an overabundance of fish.
Let's bring in a fish biologist to explain this overabundance. Stuart Ellis is with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
This year is going to be a little over 2 million fish in total. So it's a modern day record.
It's the most salmon coming back to the Columbia River system since they built the big dams in the 1920s. Alaska's had good runs, too. So salmon doing great in the Pacific Northwest, but several hundred miles south in California, a totally different story.
A
not for this year's drought, millions of salmon would be migrating down the Sacramento River right now. But instead, the salmon are headed toward the ocean in a convoy of tanker trucks. As KCRA3's David
Bean. In California, baby salmon were baking and dying earlier this year. Stuart Ellis can give the fish science for this disconnect. Favorable ocean conditions over the past few years helped salmon that are now coming back to spawn. Disastrous river conditions may kill off a bunch of the fish we would be catching and eating in 2017. The long-term problems affect the whole region. Drought, habitat loss, irrigation, climate change.
The abundance of salmon that we have, it's a sort of a conundrum to consumers because they also hear stories about ESA-listed runs of fish.
Endangered species.
Exact. It can make it quite confusing.
I think it's very complicated.
That's Northwestern marketing professor Kelly Goldsmith.
Regardless of a consumer's socioeconomic status or ability to buy, we're all concerned global warming could be an issue. We're all aware of these longer-term problems.
Goldsmith thinks it's hard for even the well-informed foodie to sort through the news, the science, the environmental labeling by groups like Seafood Watch that certify certain fish as sustainable.
Consumers kind of develop this conditioned response where if I eat salmon, I'm doing something bad, right? The salmon is delicious, but another element of my consumption experience is I feel bad for doing it because I know there's only so many left in the river. It becomes nearly impossible to know how to do the right thing.
Guilt, fear of extinction, maybe because of my plank-grilled salmon, not a recipe for consumers to feel good about a product, and yet they haven't abandoned wild salmon so far, and prices keep going up, which consumers continue to pay. Maybe to assuage the guilt? Sarah Stebbins stepped into an upscale market in Portland recently to buy salmon burgers at $10 a pound.
You want four racks separately or two and two?
I'm going to grill them. They're great on the grill.
And how much does the price matter?
Quite frankly, it doesn't, because you get what you pay for. And I really believe that we have to be responsible eaters.
Back in the Klickitat Gorge, fisherman Ira Yollop's hoping for more consumers like that. If salmon prices keep going up at the grocery store, he might get a bit more for his bumper catch on the river. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Spend a good chunk of time on this show talking about economic indicators. But for the past few weeks, we've been asking you, our listeners, to tell us what the economy feels like. Today, we hear from Colvin Baer. He's a retired public school teacher who now teaches French horn at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio.
I've been teaching horn at Wittenberg. This is my 32nd year. I have an unusual economic barometer in that I measure the number of private students that I have. I have noticed over the length of my career that when the economy is bad, the number of students is down, and when the economy is good, the number of students is up. The number went way down when the economy was bad, like some years it was only one student, and I keep hoping the next year, please don't get any worse or I won't have anybody. And right now I have a record number of students, which to me indicates that the national economy is doing rather well. People are willing to be studying music instead of worrying about some of the other careers that are usually pushed when the economy is down. I think in Ohio, even though the employment situation has improved, like much of the country, for many of the people, the job they got after the job that disappeared hasn't paid as well as what they were used to. So many people are behind quite a bit because of that. Things are better, but the people haven't come to accept it yet.
Take a second and tell us how the economy feels to you. There's a place on our website where you can do that. Just go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the show today. You know the old saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch? Well, seems like that might hold true for free shipping, too. Retailers like to promote free shipping for the holidays, but if you shop online at places like Amazon, Best Buy, or The Gap, according to the Wall Street Journal, you're going to spend more money this year to get that nice free shipping perk. The average amount last year to qualify, $76. This year, it's about $82. And that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 153 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ fell 36 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 down 14 points, 0.75%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Marketplace is back here again tomorrow. See you then. This is APM.